world as we know it, and I feel fine. Last week it starts with an earthquake, birds, snakes, and aeroplanes. Yeah, Lenny Bruce is not afraid. I have a hurricane, listen to yourself, turn worlds into its own means. Dummy, save your own needs, speed it up, and that speed got no speed. The ladder starts to clatter with the fear of fight down. Like fire in a fire, represent the southern gang from the government for hiring a combat site. Lest there wasn't coming in a hurry with the fury speeding down your neck. Team reporters grab a trunk, get the ground, look at that low plane. Find that overflow population corner, too, but it'll lose. Save yourself and save yourself a world, save your own needs, listen to your heart. Tell me that the reds are in the reference with the right. You patriotic, patriotic, slam fight, right? I'm feeling pretty psyched. It's the end of the world as we know it. It's the end of the world as we know it. It's the end of the world as we know it. I feel fine. Oh, 6 o'clock TV hour, don't get gotten born. Now session for a return. Listen to yourself, journal, a committee, uniform, a book, a burning bottle. Every moon of escalating, not a moment, incinerate. Not a motor, but a kettle, step down, step down. Watch your heel crush, crush up all this means. No fear, cavalier, renegade, sphere, clear. Tournament, a tournament, a tournament of lies. You offer the solution to not from the alternative.
And I decline.
It's the end of the world as we know it. It's the end of the world as we know it. It's the end of the world as we know it. I feel fine. It's the end of the world as we know it. It's the end of the world as we know it. I feel fine.
The other night I took the fine gutter, and I took the fine mouth, saying in a light lantern, first hand lantern, president, plenty of reason, Mr. Beck, birthday party, cheesecake, a jelly bean, boom. Patriotic, patriotic, slam, foot, next set, right.
It's the end of the world as we know it. It's the end of the world as we know it. It's the end of the world as we know it. I feel fine.
Oh, it's the
end of the world as we know it. It's the end of the world as we know it. It's the end of the world as we know it. I feel
music there from Patty Maloney and Sean Potts. The name of the
tunes. The first one is Did You Wash Your Father's Shirt? And the second one is called The Mountaintop. A pair of reels there. And we're going to talk a little bit more about The Mountaintop. But first of all, we've got an announcement or two for you. And then we're going to come back with a really fascinating interview. So please keep it right here on KGNU.
Gospel music has evolved over time, but its heart stays true. It still has an unmatched power to strike the deepest chord in all of us, touching people of all faiths and of no faith.
The Gospel Chime Hour, every Sunday morning from 7 to 9 a.m. on KGNU, your community radio station.
Gospel songs are the songs of hope. Hope that in lifting our voices together, we too might one day reach the promised land.
Scholte Gael is made possible by you, the KGNU listener member, and by The Celtic Connection. The Celtic Connection is a monthly newspaper for all people with an interest in Celtic news, music, language, culture, and tradition. For subscription information, visit CelticConnection.com or call 303-777-0502. I don't think I'd listen to that guy. At any rate, the last cut that we played by Paddy Maloney and Sean Potts, Tin Whistle Players, best known for their work with the Chieftains, was called The Mountaintop. And here in Colorado, our mountaintops were first invaded by Europeans coming to Colorado in search of precious metals, gold and lead and silver. And that period in American history was also coincident with a great exodus of people from Celtic lands, many of whom who landed here in Colorado eventually by a roundabout route. And if you are lucky enough to subscribe to Colorado Heritage Magazine, the cover article for the current issue of Colorado Heritage Magazine is all about the life of the Irish in Colorado, and particularly the life of the Irish in the Colorado mining districts. And the author of that article, and an expert in the field, is a woman by the name of Lindsay Flewelling. And Lindsay is here with us tonight. Thank you, and welcome to Scholte Gael.
Thanks for having me.
It's great to have you here. Now, bear with me while I paint a little bit of a common person's perception of the Colorado gold country. I'm thinking dirt streets and wagons and rough and tough people and lots of saloons. And paint an accurate picture for me of what life would have been like in the Colorado gold country in the late 1850s, early 1860s.
Well, in a lot of the towns, the buildings were going up so quickly that they didn't actually have organized streets. It's just people building wherever they could find empty land. Certainly, there would have been a lot of saloons. It would have been a very masculine place without many women around. Those who were there would have been prostitutes or laundresses. Or in Leadville, they had groups of nuns who came in from Ireland to be nurses. And then eventually there were more buildings built, like churches and other parts of the town infrastructure. There would have been all sorts of different mines. So in Leadville, for example, there's just numerous mines surrounding the town. And the mining life would have been incredibly hard, which led to a lot of labor strife because the conditions were so poor for the miners.
If I were there right at the earliest days of Leadville, would I have been likely to meet people from Ireland, or did they come later? What was their timing in coming to the mining camps?
I think they're there from pretty much the very beginning, because the largest group of Irish immigrants had come in between 1845 and to 1855 to the United States, and they would have slowly made their way through different mining districts So there were networks of miners from County Cork in Ireland and then Cornwall in England. And then they would come over and mine in places in Pennsylvania and Michigan and then come out farther west to Colorado and Nevada, Butte, Montana, and San Francisco. So they would have slowly made their way across the country and ended up in Colorado right around the time of the gold rush and the silver rush in Leadville.
So the people who were coming, are they primarily lower class, middle class, upper class? What's a common Irish person like in the gold camps in those days, if there is such a thing?
I think that primarily the people that were coming into the United States in this period were Catholic. They were impoverished and unskilled and mainly from rural areas. They wouldn't have had the money to be homesteaders since you need quite a bit of money up front to be a farmer. So they would have come over and worked in jobs like mining that were working class, so less elite. And then, you know, you might get lucky and strike it rich, which some children of Irish immigrants did, like J.J. Brown, for example.
J.J. Brown being the husband later of the unsinkable Molly?
That's right. Yeah. So he was the second generation Irish American, as was Margaret Tobin Brown. So he struck it rich in Leadville, and then like many other people who got lucky, moved down to Denver and settled in Capitol Hill, and then helped to build up the Denver Irish community.
What about any aristocracy, the Anglo-Irish aristocracy? Are they coming? Are non-Catholic clergy coming, Presbyterians or Church of Ireland folks?
So what I study primarily is the Protestant Irish and their immigration to America. And
I
a lot
knew
of that...
I'd asked the right person that question.
Yeah. So a lot of them had come earlier. The Anglo-Irish are just really hard to track in the United States, and they might have been more folded into the overall English immigration if they're joining Episcopalian churches. But the Protestant or Presbyterian Irish, Scots Irish, had come over in the late 1700s and early 1800s. But I think it's pretty interesting that the majority of Irish immigration didn't become Catholic until the 1830s. So most of your second generation Irish Americans are Protestant through this period. And even today, most people who have Irish ancestry are from Protestant roots.
Isn't that interesting? Because that's kind of at variance with what we think about with celebrating St. Patrick's Day and thinking of so many Irish people in the States as Roman Catholic clergy and stuff like that. So what you're telling us is something that's, at least for me, a little bit at variance with what my guess would have been.
Yeah, so I mean, the vast majority of people, because the Protestants came over so much earlier than the group of Catholic immigrants, would be descendants of the Protestants. But I think in the U.S. we've gotten more of a celebration of Irishness that transcends the religious divides, whereas in Ireland, obviously, there are still a lot of religious divides today that we don't necessarily see over here.
Right. So once people from Ireland, either first or second generation, are in places like Leadville, what do you find them doing? How do you find them coming together to celebrate their commonality? How are they distinct? To what extent are there clashes? And to what extent are the old animosities between the orange Protestant groups and the green Catholic groups? What kind of orange versus green conflict are we seeing as well?
So in Leadville, for example, you have a lot of celebration of ethnic heritage, like naming the mines after Irish nationalist heroes like Robert Emmet and Wolfe Tone, O'Donovan Rossa, and then other mines like the Fenian Queen, Charles Stuart Parnell, Maid of Erin. So you can see the heritage within the place names. You also have a building up of the Catholic presence in town, and the Irish had their own Catholic church, the Church of the Annunciation, which you can still see in Leadville today, even though it's not used as a church right now. And then there were all sorts of different ethnic organizations that people could join, which I'm particularly interested in. So you have local militias, such as the Wolf Tone Guards.
Militias, these are armed groups?
Mm-hmm. So it'd be, sometimes they're sponsored by the state even, but there wasn't a standing army at the time, so there'd be local militias formed, and then at times they'd be asked to, for example, come in and put down striking miners, or they would stand up on the side of the labor leaders. So yeah, you had the Wolf Tone Guards, which is a specifically Irish local militia in Leadville. They had different social organizations, like the Knights of Robert Emmet, the Ancient Order of Hibernians, and the Daughters of Erin. And then they had Irish nationalist organizations that were very specific to Irish nationalism, like the Land League and the Ladies Land League in the 1880s.
Sure, National Land League. There turns up in a number of folk songs of the period, and it's interesting that you say that the militia might have either stood on the sidelines or become actively involved in a conflict, depending upon what their political persuasion is. Who got to call those shots? Who was in charge, or were the militias voting on which side they'd be involved in, and how did that work with the organizations like the Ancient Order of Hibernians that you mentioned?
Well, I think that the militias would have been formed of local miners, so it probably depended on how they sided in the labor conflicts. So, for example, there were two major strikes in Leadville, one in 1880, which was led by an immigrant from Dublin named Michael Mooney, and then one in 1896, which was led by the Western Federation of Miners and Edward Boyce, who is also an Irish-American. So just logically, you would think that the miners who are of Irish descent in the Wolf Tone Guards would be more likely to favor the labor movement rather than the owners of the mines.
And what else were people doing? I mean, they couldn't have been drilling with the militia or actively working in the mines all the time. Were they raising families? You said there's a dearth of women there. What are they doing for recreation and society?
So they had the different ethnic organizations that would be a big draw for your free time. And these would be organizations that were mutual benefit societies, so you could get sickness benefits and death benefits, but also social organizations. So for example, in Cripple Creek, they had different social clubs that were unique to the Irish, the Sheridan and Sarsfield clubs that only Irish Americans could join. Like I said, the labor movements was very active among the Irish Americans. And that is true across the United States. The Irish are associated with the labor movement. They're active in Democratic Party politics, and then also active in Irish nationalist organizations throughout the United States, but particularly in Leadville. And we talked about the Land League. The Irish in Leadville ranked third nationally in their support of the Irish Land League, behind only Philadelphia and Chicago, which I think is just mind-boggling that a place that's that new and small could raise that much money in support of the Irish nationalism.
When I read that in your article, I was totally blown away that it was Philadelphia and Chicago and then Leadville and not Boston and New York, mm-hmm. which I would have just, you know, reflexively assumed that that's the way it works. But how interesting. And why? Was it because there were terrific organizers in Leadville, or why the intense contribution of capital to the Land League fight back in Ireland?
I think that when you're in a sort of isolated place like that, it really helps people to stake a claim in America to be able to join organizations like the Land League and other nationalist organizations, helps them to advance their lives in the United States while also supporting the causes of their homeland. So it keeps you tied back home while also gaining a foothold in the United States. And since Leadville is so isolated compared to its major cities that would have been supporting the Land League, I think that maybe that was a big source of camaraderie to be able to come together in the Irish nationalist movement.
Really interesting. To what extent, I mean, nowadays when we think about Irish culture being celebrated in the United States, even if we're talking about little kids step dancing and things like that, a lot of the culture centers around Irish pubs or churches and schools. Was that true then as well?
So they had, like I said, their own Catholic churches. So in Leadville is the Church of the Annunciation. In Denver, it would have been St. Patrick's Church, St. Leo's in Auraria, and the Immaculate Conception Cathedral. So church life was important. For children, there would have been schools through the Catholic Church. I think it was St. Mary's in Leadville. And then you have saloons and other meeting places in towns that they would have gathered at as well.
And were there dances? Were there people doing sets and jigs and reels like we see around St. Patrick's Day in Denver? Or was it a lower key, more relaxed ambiance?
I think there were dances once in a while, but for the most part, it would have been probably lower key or more military oriented in the celebration of nationality. So if you were a part of the Wolftone Guards, you would do armed drills and things like that.
And then go drink with the guys in your regiment.
Yeah, I'm sure. And then through the different associations, you would have picnics and different outings, and then different, trying to think of how to describe this, but you have your associational life, so different like mystical rituals and things like that, that the men would be a part of.
Knights of Columbus or Ancient Order of Hibernians you mentioned before.
And then for Irish Protestants, you have the Orange Order, which there were 17 lodges in Colorado.
Wow.
Three at least in Denver and one in Leadville and one in Cripple Creek. And they sort of combine that mysticism and ritual with being extremely anti-Catholic and trying to promote a nativist American point of view.
Our guest is Dr. Lindsay Flewellen, who has the cover article in this month's issue of Colorado Heritage Magazine, published by History Colorado. And the article is about Irish life in the mining camps of Colorado. On the cover of the magazine, there is a cartoon of a notable Irishman, Fingal O'Flaherty Wills Wild. And what is his connection with the Irish in Colorado?
So Oscar Wilde went on a tour of North America in 1882, and it was a year-long tour. He visited Leadville in April of 1882 and also visited Denver and Colorado Springs. But it was particularly Leadville that he noted in his own writings and is reflected in this cartoon, which is from Harper's Bazaar, and I think it's just really wonderful cartoon. He's holding up some miner's boots and a hat, and there's flowers growing out of the boots, and then there's a little depiction of Leadville up in the corner. He lectured the miners in Leadville on art and aesthetics at the Tabor Opera House, which I think is just wonderful. Then he went to a dancing saloon and noted that they were asking people not to shoot the pianist, which he really enjoyed. Then he had to descend into the mine in Leadville in a bucket. And then he said he had a supper. The first course was whiskey, the second course was whiskey, and the third course was whiskey. so he really appreciated that. So this would have been, well, it's 1882. It's before he becomes really famous. So he wrote The Picture of Dorian Gray in 1890 and The Importance of Being Earnest in 1895. But he was still known for his writings and as a humorist and for his wit and social commentary by this period.
That's just fascinating. Is there any record of what the reaction of the people in the mining community was to this person that I don't think of as a bushy bearded Tommy Knocker kind of a miner?
Well, Oscar Wilde at least claims that the reaction was very positive. So I think that he just really loved being in Leadville based on his own writings and the things that he said later on. So the political cartoon where he's celebrating the miners' clothes came out of something he said about the miners of Leadville being the best dressed people that he came across on his North American tour. And he was talking about that in New York several months later. So it really stuck with him.
Was he being sarcastic or?
I'm sure. Yes.
Oh, dear. Fascinating. Anyone else of his caliber that came through Leadville that comes to mind?
Well, Colorado and Leadville in particular was the site of many different visits by Irish politicians at the time. And there was a tradition of nationalist tours of the United States to try to raise funds for Irish nationalism. So the founder of the Land League, Michael Davitt, came to Colorado twice, as well as a few other Land League officers coming over from Ireland. And there were also several other Irish MPs that visited Leadville and Denver. And then in 1919, the Irish president, Eamon de Valera, came to Colorado. Leadville, by then, was in serious decline. But he visited Denver, Idaho Springs, and Pueblo as part of his tour to try to gain recognition of the Irish Republic from the United States government.
And de Valera would have been here just very shortly before the Irish Rising the proclamation of the Irish Republic.
It was just after that, actually.
Okay.
So the proclamation of the Irish Republic was in 1916.
Right, right.
And then de Valera was spared because of his American background. And then he went on a tour of the United States in 1919 and 1920 to try to gain recognition of the Irish Republic. He went back to Ireland, and then that's when you have the treaty and then the
Establishment of the Republic, right?
Yeah, and then the Irish Civil War. And what I think is really interesting about his visit to Colorado is at the same time you have a group of Ulster Protestant ministers who's touring the United States to protest against what de Valera is saying and to protest against Irish self-government because they want to maintain the union with Britain. So they came to Colorado in early 1920. And then right after them, another Irish nationalist, Lindsay Crawford, came over as part of the Protestant Friends of Ireland to argue that the Irish should have self-government. So you see this argument back and forth in the people visiting Denver to try to convince the Denverites of what side they should be on in Irish politics.
Not unlike Fox and MSNBC today.
Right. It's just interesting that it's a different country that's coming over. So
right.
They made a lot of efforts on both the Nationalists and the Unionists to try to get Americans to support them.
Very, very interesting stuff. So what happens when mining starts to peter out in Leadville? Where do people go? What do people do?
Some people would continue to be part of the mining network that we were talking about earlier. So they would move on to different mines in other places. They might move down to some of the coal mining communities near Boulder or on the Front Range. They also moved to Denver and became police officers or did more urban activities. And in Denver, they built up different Irish fraternal organizations and religious life there as well. So by the early 1900s, Denver was the most Irish city in Colorado, whereas it had been Leadville before. And I think it was 44% of the Irish in Colorado were in Denver by 1910.
Wow. So there really is a migration down out of the mining camps and into the growing cities along what's becoming the Front Range.
That's right.
Interesting. How, let's move away just for a second from the meat of your research. How did you do your research? How did you get interested in these issues? And then how did you go about trying to figure out what your source material would be and drilling down into it?
So I've always been interested in the history of the American West, and I got more interested in Irish history when I was in college at the University of Oklahoma. I took a really great Irish history class there. And what I'm really interested in is sort of parallel history, so seeing what's happening in two different places at the same time and trying to figure out connections between them. So when I was doing my PhD, I was looking at how Unionists in Ulster were trying to appeal to the United States, and I thought it's just weird to think about all these Irish uprisings happening while people are taking covered wagons out to the West. Like, they don't seem like they should be happening in the same universe. So you have Charles Stuart Parnell, you know, giving speeches in Parliament while people are in covered wagons and starting mining in Colorado. So I was interested in how these two things were happening at the same time and the connections between them. Ulster Unionists used examples from the American West in their speeches all the time and appealed to the Scotch-Irish frontier and pioneering traditions. So they really are related, even though they don't seem like they're in the same world. So for this article in particular, last fall I was taking a class at CU Denver in Colorado history, and we were visiting Leadville. So as part of that, my teacher, Tom Noel, asked me to put together a little talk on the Irish in Leadville, and that led me to get really interested in the Irish in Colorado, and been particularly interested in different ethnic groups in Colorado in the first place. So this was really fun to do research.
And where did you do the research? Were you looking online at particular archives in the state or elsewhere? Where did you spend most of your time?
I do research at Norland Library at CU and then at the Denver Public Library primarily.
The fifth floor, the great Western History and Genealogy section?
Yeah, that's right. So I was looking there. And then part of the greater context is from my PhD thesis, so looking at how the Irish political movements played out in the United States and how that ends up being illustrated through people's lives in Colorado.
So help me to bring it forward to the United States and Colorado and the Denver metropolitan area now. If I am down in Denver and I want to reach out and touch Celtic history somehow, either in Leadville or in Denver, or even here in Boulder, where can I go? Are there places that I can go other than cemeteries to reach out and physically connect with some small element of Irish culture in Colorado right now?
So I think that because Leadville is a more, they had a very concentrated Irish population there, and they had ethnic enclaves, so it's easier to find remnants of the Irish today in Leadville because of the enclaves in different neighborhoods. So the Irish were settled on the east side of the city, and East 6th Street was the primary hub of the Irish neighborhood, and that's on the east side of Harrison Avenue. So if you go there today, you can still see Victorian houses in that part of town that would have been around and settled by the Irish.
One more time, 6th Avenue and which cross street?
So it's east of Harrison Avenue on 6th Street.
6th Street, not 6th Avenue.
Right.
Okay.
And then there you can still see the Church of the Annunciation. And if you go on the train in Leadville, you can see St. Vincent's Hospital, which was staffed by Irish nuns. So you can still see that today as well. I think in Denver, it's a little bit harder to find the actual places where Irish Americans were because there were not ethnic enclaves of the Irish specifically. You do have some enclaves of groups like the Chinese down on Wazee Street, but not necessarily the Irish. So they're spread out around the town, and you can see that sort of makes sense when you see how many Irish Catholic churches there are in different places around the town.
Right.
So the richest Irish Americans lived on Capitol Hill. So you can see the Molly Brown House, for example. J.K. Mullen, who's the leading Irish businessman in Denver, lived in Capitol Hill as well. And they joined together to help build different Catholic churches like St. Patrick's, St. Leo's, which is no longer there, and then the Immaculate Conception Cathedral, which obviously is a huge landmark today. They also helped to build St. Joseph's Hospital.
Oh.
But other than those major landmarks, it's probably a little harder to find evidence of the Irish there today.
So if I go to the cemeteries in Denver, would I go to Riverside? Would I go to, one of the other cemeteries? And is there anything in Boulder that we can find as well?
I'm not so sure about the cemeteries. I'd imagine that any cemetery that has a Catholic
section
would
sure.
Have some Irish buried there. Boulder was more mixed ethnically, and is an agriculture and supply town, so you don't have the huge numbers of Irish. And then in the surrounding towns, you have a lot of Catholic presence, but not so much Irish. So, Louisville is known for being an Italian town. In Superior, you have a lot of Polish Catholics, and there's some Scottish Highland Catholics as well, but not huge numbers of Irish. So it's a little bit harder to find in Boulder County, I think.
Thank you very, very much for coming to join us. Any other good stories that you have that come to mind that you'd like to finish up with to send us out here?
I think when I was doing my research, one person that really struck me as being completely fascinating was Joseph Murray, who is a labor leader in Denver. He was born in Dublin and migrated to Manchester to work in the mills there. And like many Irish who migrated to England, he became active in the Irish nationalist movement after moving over there. He ended up going to Italy to fight for Italian independence against the Austrians in 1859, and then came to the United States to fight for the Union in the Civil War.
Ah.
He moved to Colorado as part of the Greeley Agricultural Colony.
Oh,
and
really?
Then,
came with the Union Colony.
Yeah. And then became a labor leader with the Knights of Labor. And his whole idea was to promote unity among the workers of the world. But I think that he also just really embodies the international flavor and how much the Irish participated in different international movements around the world. And I think it's just fascinating that he went to so many different places and then ended up in Colorado and was inspired to be a labor leader here.
I got an email here from one of our listeners. John wrote, another interesting feature of Leadville was that there wasn't much there for a laborer to invest in. So it might have been difficult if you'd managed to pull together a grub stake to be able to put down roots and stay there long term, as opposed to Boston or New York or even Denver. Does that comport with your research as well?
Definitely. And then after the silver crash in the 1890s, people really, lost all of their savings and had to move elsewhere. So that drove a lot of people to go to Denver and to other mining camps. So it'd be hard to stay in Leadville long term.
So what's next for you? You've got this great article. You've got your doctorate. You're doing some teaching. What's the long-term goal for Lindsay Flewelling?
Well, I have a book based on my thesis coming out in, I think, March of next year.
That's exactly what we wanted to know. So it's coming out right around St. Patrick's Day.
That's right. But it's about the Protestant Irish, so
that's okay.
It doesn't fit that well with that. But yeah, it's called Two Irelands Beyond the Sea, Ulster Unionism and America, 1880 to 1920. And it's published by Liverpool University Press. And it's talking about how Irish Protestants tried to appeal to the United States to gain funding and recognition from Americans to try to equal Irish nationalists. They were not that successful compared to Irish nationalists. And then also the Scotch-Irish organizations in the United States.
Before I let you go, I can't leave that question hanging. Why do you think the Unionists were less successful than the Nationalists in fundraising?
The Nationalists had a more united support base to draw from, and I think they had better PR. The Unionists had a really hard time appealing to Americans because Unionism isn't really romantic like nationalism is to appeal to an American base. And the people who are descendants of the Scotch-Irish were further back, so their connections to Ireland were less strong than the nationalists in a lot of ways. And then they also had really mixed messaging because some Unionists felt like Great Britain should be representing them to the United States, while others thought that the Unionists should be going over and doing it themselves. So there was conflict within their own movement. So their efforts were really mixed over time and uneven. One thing I found really fascinating, though, is that throughout the Home Rule period, which is what I was looking at, the Unionists used American examples to support their own movement. For example, they would say, you know, the North fought the South to support the Union and try to save the Union in America. Why isn't Britain stepping in to fight Ireland to try to save the Union with Ireland? Or my favorite is the Revolutionary War. The Americans fought against coercion against the British, and the Unionists were saying that they would fight against the coercion of home rule to try to save the Union instead of break away.
Very, very interesting. Dr. Lindsay Flewelling, thank you very much for coming in. And if you haven't had a chance, get a copy of Colorado Heritage Magazine. The current issue is available online at the History Colorado website, and Dr. Flewelling's terrific article is front and center there in the magazine. It's terrific reading. It's a great opportunity to learn a lot. And thank you very much for being with us this evening.
Great. Thank you.
It's great to have you here. Music there from the Tannehill Weavers and the title cut from a CD entitled The Arnish Light. And the Arnish Light set is the name of that. We've got a ticket giveaway. We've got one of those great giveaways where it's got lots of facets to it. So let me just tell you a little bit about it. And let me also tell you the number that you can call when we're ready. So don't dial it now, but the number that you're going to want to call is 303-442-4242. I'll give that to you one more time at the end of the discussion, but we have two guest list tickets with camping privileges at the Maybon concert, and it is a great concert. I'll tell you about it here in just a second. We ask that you not have won anything from KGNU in the last 30 days, and that you can make it to the show, and that you be a KGNU listener member. So here's what you need to know about this show. It's an all-ages show. It starts at 8 p.m. on September 23rd, so 2 weeks from this Saturday, and it's hard to think of an artist in Irish traditional music more influential than Seamus Egan. From the beginning of his career as a teen prodigy, where he won 4 All-Ireland championships on 4 different instruments when he was 14 years of age, to his groundbreaking solo work with Shanachie Records, to his founding of Irish-American powerhouse band Solas, to his current work as one of the leading composers and interpreters of the Celtic tradition. Seamus has inspired multiple generations of musicians and helped define the sound of Irish music today. So these are guest list tickets. So they will be at the door of the venue, which is Planet Bluegrass in Lyons, Colorado. Once again, the show date is September 23rd. Up at Planet Bluegrass in Lyons. And if you would like to go, you can give us a call and we'll take the third caller at 303-442-4242. That's 303-442-4242 for a pair of guest list tickets to the Maybon Festival at Planet Bluegrass. There also is a great local opening band. It's my good friends in a band called Take Down the Door, which is Jesse and Adam and John and let's see, who am I? Oh yeah, Beth, of course. And they will be holding forth as the opening act for Seamus. And then if I know all of those folks, there's going to be a great hooli or a session later in the evening as well. So your camping privileges are something that you're really going to want to take advantage of. Give us a call, 303-442-4242. That's 303-442-4242. And be our third caller at KGNU. And to get us in the spirit, nothing other than Seamus Egan and Solas themselves on KGNU. Music there from Solas. It's off of an album called Waiting for an Echo, and the title cut, or the first cut, the lead cut on the CD, is a set of tunes, The Hanover Reel, John James Reel, and The Copper Plate. I'd like to thank once again Dr. Lindsay Flewelling for joining us and educating us on the Irish and the Colorado mining districts. Just really terrific to have a chance to listen and learn from her. So, Dr. Flewelling, thank you once again. Do catch her article in the Colorado Heritage Magazine online. And we are climbing up on the 8 o'clock hour here at KGNU. You are listening to KGNU, Boulder, Denver, and Fort Collins, 88.5 FM, 1390 on AM, and 93.7 FM in Nederland, and 98.7 FM in Fort Collins. Musica Mundi from all around the world with Yuket is coming your way next. Thank you very much for listening. I'm Carl Cumley saying have a very good evening on KGNU. Thank you.